W and trois bytes. And but what it is understanding this quantum Teichmuller theory, which was really started. So the person who really started this is Volodya Fock, and with Leo Chekhov. And also, in a parallel there is a parallel theory due to Kashayev, Rinat. And it all started with actually an attempt to really understand what those guys were doing. You know, they tend to be physicists. It's not always very easy to follow what they are doing. On the other hand, I mean, you know the way with physicists, we keep making fun of them, because their theorems don't make sense, the definitions are horrible, and so on. However, they are the ones with a clear insight on things. Right? So I think we should borrow, we should certainly try to understand what they are doing. And the general idea is that you take, okay, so this is a workshop on hyperbolic geometry. And what you do, you take whatever we do in hyperbolic geometry, and we deform. So everything becomes quantum. Namely, it depends on. So there are two ways to quantize. One which uses the Planck constant H, and so the physicists think that this is a constant which is it's not zero, but it's very very small. And then the other version is to consider exponential of IH, where again H is very small, so and you call this Q. So it all depends whether you take exponentials or not. And so the idea that you have to think of being Q as being very, very close to 1. And when Q is exactly equal to 1, this is supposed to reflect, quote, reality. And the reality, in this workshop, reality is a real hyperbolic geometry. So what, now, you know, I've been giving these talks, talks about this for 3 or 4 years even. And a lot of people may feel like I've heard something similar, and they may feel, and I feel, like I'm always giving the same talk. But actually, it's not true. It's very incremental, but each time I understand my talk a little better. And certainly, what's happening is, if you look very carefully, you can see that each time the results get better and better, and the picture gets clearer. So first, instead of... So I just pull it up, or do I do something else? No, just need a little bit of oil in that thing. So first, let's talk about the. First, I'm going to talk about things which a lot of people here know about, namely classical hyperbolic geometry. So let S be a punctured surface. Namely, it's something which can write as S bar minus points, minus P points. So this is a closed, and at some point it will need to be oriented, so I might as well surface. And, well, these are the punctures. So it's something which looks like this. And so that's S bar, no punctures, and then you drill holes. And at this point, the theory works only when you have at least one hole. So let's puncture one hole. And then you have this idea of ideal triangulation. Of S, if I call it lambda. And what that is, this is a triangulation of S bar with vertices V1, the punctures, at the punctures. Okay, so so it looks like something like this. So usually you draw it this way, and of course, because you don't see what's in the back of the picture, you can complete it the way you want. Now, otherwise, you need many more edges than what I drew. And so you have to realize there are many, many more punctures in the back which I didn't draw. And in this way, my picture becomes correct. Okay. And so what's important? So it has edges. F1, Fn. No, sorry. It has edges lambda 1, lambda n for lambda. So you can always see a development here. The fact is because they used to be called a geodesic lamination in my mind. Not a triangulation. It was a complete geodesic lamination. And it has faces when F1, Fm, and n and m, the number of edges and the number of faces, depend only on the topology of the surface. It doesn't depend on the lamination. Okay, so then there is something we can do. Once we fix a lamination, once we fix an ideal triangulation like this, we have a map phi lambda going from the complex numbers non-zero n to the space of group homomorphisms R from the fundamental group of the surface to PSL to C, namely the isometric group of the hyperbolic plane. And, so it's something which people in this room are relatively familiar with. This is based on pleated surfaces. And so here is how it works. Okay, so I have my surface here. So that's a topological object. And I have my ideal triangulation. Okay. Then I look at the universal cover. So a lot of people think that the universal, a lot of people will write that the universal cover is H2. No, you have to think of it as a flexible object. And then this leads to an ideal triangulation of this of this universal cover, so it's in decomposition into triangles. Okay, perhaps I should stop. And then, if I'm given a complex number here for each edge, then I have a natural way to define the map F tilde. From this, so now this picture is round, and it's supposed to be a picture of the hyperbolic tree space. And what I'm going to do is that each triangle here, I'm going to send it here to a straight triangle here. So that's this one here. And this one here, I'm going to also to send it to another one, like this, and I'm going to keep doing it. So I'm sending each triangle to an ideal triangle here, where these are geodesics and the points are on the sphere at infinity. And the way it works is that to this vertex I have associated the coordinates xi corresponding to this. And so if you think about how can two ideal triangles match, well, there are two degrees of freedom. You can, first of all, shift them like this. So you measure the shift along this edge by projecting. In fact, Jason brought this nice color to me. You take the projection of the third vertex here. You take the projection of the third vertex to this one. This is supposed to be a right angle. And you look at this distance here. What was going to be yellow? So let's call this T for translation. And then another thing you can do, so that's going to measure the shift in that direction, and also you can bend. And the way you measure the bending is by the angle. Let's try yellow for this one. And you do it in such a way that that complex number here, which was associated to the edge, x white I, is going to be exponential of T for translation plus theta times I. Well, because I use the letter I, let me use square root of minus 1. Okay. So it's a lot of people in this room are familiar with, they are a little more, and what's happening is that because the assignment, CN is supposed to represent the data of a weight associated to each edge here. So here he gives you an assignment of weight which is invariant under the action of the fundamental group. And because of a uniqueness in this construction, actually this thing is going to be invariant under a certain action of isometries. And so we're going to have F tilde is a covariant with respect to a group homomorphism R from the fundamental group of the surface to the isometric group of H3, which is also PSL2C. Okay, and so what as a covariant means, means that if you take F tilde of gamma X tilde, so for every gamma in the fundamental group, F tilde of this is equal to F tilde of X tilde, and not a good choice to use X, I'm sorry. Let's take P, and then R of gamma. And that's what that is. Okay, so in particular, again, a lot of people in this room are familiar with the case where, so example, where R not only exists but happens to be discrete. And so this picture here, I have S with these functions. And so I have S tilde. So this goes to the hyperbolic space H3. But if R is discrete, I can consider H3 mod R of pi 1 of M. I can consider the quotient space, which is a hyperbolic, if there is no torsion, it's going to be a hyperbolic manifold. And what the covariant says is that it factors from that like this. And so this goes to something which is going to look like this. So the picture is the following. So some functions are going to give you, so the map should keep the same genus. How many functions did I put? So this is supposed to be in H3 mod R of pi 1 of the surface. And so that surface gives you, so it's got corners. I'm not doing the corners, but my decomposition into triangles here give you a decomposition here. And what people who have thought about this know that what's happening near the boundary is that you can have spiraling like this, oops, perspective this way, or some of these things go things happen in the back. Huh? So that's what a pleated surface looks like. And in particular, near the boundary, you have two types of phenomena. You can have a cusp, or the boundary could wrap around a closed geodesic. And in addition, when it wraps around the closed geodesic, you have two possibilities. While you have a closed geodesic, you can spiral this way, or you can spiral the other way. That gives you more information. And one way to understand that is that when I have a puncture, and if I look at all the edges which come near that puncture, well, so that gives me a series of edges, a series of triangles converging to the point in the boundary at infinity of the surface, and then they all come here to the same point. So I have actually some extra data, which is that, I should have used the same thing, but it's easier to rewrite it. So my map phi lambda, which to Cn star, namely to a system of weights on the edges of lambda, associates a group homomorphism. That's the way the map is defined. So usually, so this one we usually call R of S. That's the representation variety of the fundamental group of the surface. But we have additional information, which is that what you see is that for every puncture, so Vk, well, if you take gamma k, a loop around Vk, so red is a nice color, like this, well, you get a point x, pk. We get a point pk or zk in the boundary at infinity of the hyperbolic space invariant. Invariant under R of gamma k. So not only, so you have this additional information, which is a plus point of the boundary at infinity of H3, which are fixed by the peripheral elements. Okay, now let's try to think about it in this picture here. When my puncture corresponds to a cusp, I need a point at infinity which is fixed by this curve. Well, it's a parabolic element. There is only one fixed point, so actually no choice for the cusp. When the boundary is loxodromic, like this corresponds to a closed geodesic, well, it's a translation. It has two fixed points, one corresponding in the positive direction, one corresponding to the negative. So it's exactly the same as what you need if you need to choose to specify the direction of the spiraling near the closed geodesic. Well, it's really a minor thing. And so so this thing here, we're going to call this an enhanced group homomorphism. And so the space of enhanced group homomorphisms, well, let's call that R hat. Essentially, it's a representation, right? It's a branch cover of the representation variety. It's a finite branch cover because you only have infinitely many choices. There is only one bad case is when this guy goes to the identity. Then then you have many choices for fixed points. So that's why it's not exactly finite to one. But, okay, if you stay away from that, although it's an interesting case, you're going to have all the polyhedra there, for instance. Yeah, so that's part of it. There are only two. There are only two fixed points. So in full generality, this is very complicated. However, you know, usually we care only about the discrete representations, in which case you don't have any problem here. Okay, and so here is a little lemma, which is going to, so it's a lemma which most people in this room can prove, which is the following. So if I take, let me take R to be phi lambda of x1 xn. I put the system of weight on the edges, and it's R plus the, so it's an enhanced R, namely with the system of fixed points. And so what the lemma says is that, let me look at H. So you know, whenever I change lambda, the ideal triangulation, well, I'm going to get most of the, I mean, actually for many of these elements here, I'm going to get almost every interesting group homomorphism, you obtain it for every ideal triangulation. Okay, there are a few nasty ones like the reducible representation, which you will not get for some ideal representation. But in most cases, you will. And is there some data here which you can read only from R? And there is an important one, which is X1, the product of Xn. And so that's the claim that this depends only on R, I mean the enhanced R, and not on lambda. Okay, so that's the product of the coordinates. Well, you know, if I say it this way, perhaps it's surprising, but everybody knows that. And the reason is because, so here is the proof. The proof is that, well, let's take gamma 1, gamma k, these peripheral elements, these peripheral curves. Well, if you have an R like this, you can cause there are p functions. So let's the length be the complex length of this curve for the presence R. Essentially, it's the trace of the corresponding element. And so there is a formula which expresses H as you take the complex, you can take exponential of the complex length of gamma k. You put a plus or minus, you take the square root of that, and you take the product of this from k equal 1 to p. Namely, you take the product. Now, there is a little bit of a subtlety here. Listen, people know that a little bit. People know that actually, when you have spiraling like this, people know that the length of this is the sum of this shear factor. It's the sum of the shear factor t's corresponding to the n. So the only trick is that it's plus or minus because it depends whether you spiral to the left or to the right. So this quantity without the square root is completely determined by the representation plus the enhancement, which just means an orientation on the boundary. Eh? The little problem is that you have to take the square root. And, you know, for complex numbers, there are slight problems about square roots. I don't know if you heard of that. the way to do it correctly is that you have to lift the representation from PSL to C to SL to C, and then it makes sense, and then you check that it doesn't depend on the lift. Eh? Okay, it's a little lemma, it's not, but it's going to be important later on. Okay, well, so that's the geometry. And as I said before, many people in this room, not only have they seen this before, but the people like me have been working with this for ages. So now let's talk about something which people have been working on for ages, but not in this room in general. So that's algebra. You know, so this whole construction is always based on the following geometric fact, which is that it's something about triangles. And the big property is that in the hyperbolic space, there is only one triangle, one ideal triangle up to isometry. Well, now, if you see a triangle, and here in algebra, you can also do something. So first of all, it's an oriented triangle. And you can also order, you can put a symbol on each. So a triangle has three edges. And so to each of these edges, we're going to define the triangle algebra, T for not T for Teichmuller, T for triangle, it's generated with generators X1, x2, x3, which you think of as being associated to a triangle. I want them to be orientable, so I'm going to formally introduce inverses, and I put relators. So it's going to depend on a Q, this Q here, and relators are going to be that xi plus 1 is equal to Q squared xi plus 1 xi. So what you have to think of it is that this is an algebra of Laurent polynomials in three variables, and you manipulate those things. In particular, you multiply them according to the rule of polynomials, except that they don't quite commute. They commute modulo this. What's important here is that it's a scalar. It's not a variable. So it takes a little while to get used to this. It was it's fairly simple. It's actually a variation of a well-known algebra to mathematical physicists, which is the Weyl algebra, where you only have two generators and one relation like this. And the reason why it's pretty much the same is that there is a very important element here, capital H, which is the product x1, x2, x3. And then let me put a q minus 1 in front to make it look nicer. And what's important here is that it's central. And actually, if you kill the central element, then you get the Weyl algebra. But for the topologies, this one is nicely symmetric. And there is a very easy proposition, which are that the irreducible representation. So what's a representation of an algebra? That's an algebra homomorphism from T, Q in this case, to the endomorphisms of M of V, where V is a, so I want it to be finite dimensional vector space. And so you have this irreducible representation. They are classified by numbers x1, x2, x3, and then h in C star. And with the property, so I forgot to say one thing, is that this theorem is very easy in the when Q is not a root of unity, because when Q is not a root of unity, there is no finite dimensional representation. This relation here, when you have a representation, this obliges the representation to be finite, to be infinite dimensional if Q is not a root of unity. So I'm going to assume that Q to the power 2n is 1 for some n, and then I'm going to let n be larger and larger later on. And so the correspondence, the way you classify these representations is by, if this is the case, I have a central element here. I have another one, which is xi to the power n. When q to the power 2n is 1, this is also a central element. And then what you know is that when you have an irreducible representation and a central element, then it has to go necessarily to a multiple of the identity. So in particular, you have that rho of xi to the power n. So you take the generator here to the power n. Well, it's going to be the identity of V times a scalar, where that scalar is exactly what this xi is. And also rho of h is also is also a multiple of the identity V. And because H, this was the product of X1, X2, X3, it's not very hard to see that Hn has to be equal to, so Hn is related to the other one as being the product. That's where the Q minus 1 is useful. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a Q here, which is annoying. Okay? Okay, so let's try to think about it. So, and this is purely, just a minute, Bruce. This is purely algebraic. It's very elementary. The goal is just you play with eigenvalues. You can explain that to your undergraduate linear algebra class, and even not the advanced one where you do Jordan and things like that. The very elementary one. Yeah, Bruce. Quantum. No. I mean, this one here. So first of all, this one is my version of what they are doing. Why do they look at the Weyl algebra? It's because of this formulation of quantum mechanics, where how do they say that? Well, you know, in the tangent, in the cotangent bundle of a manifold, things don't commute anymore. Yeah? So they are more interested in the Weyl algebra. This is my formulation. And the goal is to take whatever they are doing. See, what they do is they put choices everywhere. And then by some mysterious fact, eventually they say, hey, that doesn't depend on the choices. Well, I like to put it in a nice symmetric way. Yeah? And this is nicely symmetric. Okay, so the point is the following. So this is a very, very simple algebra, but if you have a triangle with numbers associated to the edges of the triangle, and you choose an nth root, but you know, I mean, there are only finitely many choices, then you get an interesting algebraic object. Well, here we have triangles, we had numbers, and there was an interesting geometric object. So perhaps we can mix the two. Eh? And but before we do that, so we're going to create now, we're going to start from this triangle and create something which is associated to the... I'm sorry? Yeah. A lot of physicists might disagree with you, but they think of themselves as being physicists, yes, and they certainly write like physicists.
So how far is this?
What's really coming? It's the next 5 minutes. This is just warm up, but now we get. So that's what's coming. So now that's actually, I'm going to use the word Chekhov and Fock. Actually, let's do that. So this is the Chekhov Fock algebra of lambda. Lambda is an ideal triangulation. Okay, so here is the thing. So you take lambda, an ideal triangulation. So again, the edges are lambda 1, lambda n, and the faces, f1, fm, and the vertices are the punctures, you remember that. And so it is a combinatorial object. And then, now the new thing is that for each face, well, I have a triangle. Yeah? So I have these algebraic objects, so let T, J, Q be the triangle algebra associated to the face FJ. Okay, so here is the picture. Here is a face. I have many faces, and I have some topology. I'm not going to try to draw that on the topology. For each of these faces, I have a triangle algebra like this. Well, then I can take the I can take the tensor product. Now, I know how familiar people are with this. I can take the tensor product of all these algebras. Now, don't be scared of tensor products. What that means is they are everywhere in this thing. What that means is that for each of these triangles, I have three sides. So each triangle gives me three generators. And within a triangle, they satisfy a relation like this. And then when you take generators which are outside, which are not in the same triangle, it just means they commute. That's all, eh? So it's a polynomial algebra with three times as many generators as you have faces. And then they commute. And now for each edge, lambda I, well, so here is lambda I. Lambda I separates two faces. So I have a generator coming from this face and a generator. So it's contained in the faces F, J, and F, J prime. And so I have a generator on both sides. So which one do I take? Well, I don't know, so I take both of them. Eh? It's a tensor. Good point. I will have to think about it. What I take is what I just said. I think it's a tensor product anyway. Yeah, it's a symmetric product. Thank you. I told you that you should not get scared of tensor products. You should not be scared of symmetric products either. Yeah, thank you. Come on, it's what's really important to understand what that's supposed to be. Okay, so let me put hat, symmetrize. Yeah. So the point is that what I'm going to do is that I'm going to associate to it the product X. So, you know, on this side, if this is J and this is J prime, well, to this I space, I have a generator X I J on one side and X I J prime on the other side, and you take the tensor product, well, the product. Eh? So in this way, and I'm going to call this XI. So this belongs to the tensor product or symmetric product of one face and the other face on the other side. And that's contained in the big one. And you take the... you're completely right, it's a symmetric product. And you take the image here. So here we don't have any choices. It's nicely symmetric and it's well defined. And so definition is that the Chekhov-Fock algebra of lambda is so T lambda Q, which is contained in this symmetric product of the triangle algebras. So it's a horrible algebra, and it's generated by XI, which is associated to the edges. Okay, so what this is telling, so you just have, what you have, we have one generator associated to each edge, and then when you look, it inherits from these relations in triangles, it inherits this skew commutativity relation. The numbers here are going to change a little bit according to the combinatorics of the combinatorics of the ideal triangulation, and so this is an algebra n plus or minus one. This is an algebra of Laurent polynomial which satisfies this weird commutativity relation. Okay. And, so that's really what the physicists are doing. And really, this looks very weird, but there is this important theorem. I think I want to put it here. So, theorem due to Chekhov and Fock. I mean, with... with a few details which were cleaned up by my student Xiaobo Liu, and which says that so you have this construction depends on lambda, and what happens when lambda, when you change lambda, well, you have sort of coordinate changes. So for every two lamination, ideal triangulation, there exists an algebra isomorphism between this horrible algebraic object associated to lambda prime, if you have to go this way, the horrible algebraic object associated to lambda, and so and this phi lambda lambda prime q. Okay, and we satisfy. Two conditions. One is that phi of lambda lambda second is equal to phi of lambda lambda prime. So if I have another one, I have another map going this way, and you want the diagram to be commutative. So lambda prime lambda second. So I put q's everywhere. And so it's well behaved when you take three of them. That looks like a pretty innocuous relation, right? And then there is something you call a locality condition, which says, I'm going to say it with words, but it's recorded, so it doesn't matter. with words, it just says that if lambda and lambda prime are very close, are the same almost everywhere, then this thing is the identity almost everywhere. Right? So, namely, you could just see it, you just compute it locally. Well, so that looks pretty innocuous. Actually, it's very hard. It's very hard to find an example which satisfies that. And the reason is that you have to find the solution to the so-called pentagon. Right, okay, it's hard. I'm going to skip that. And it required actually deep insight on the part of the physicists. So really here, what's really important is to find how it works. One hint that this is hard is this result of my student Hua Bai, which is that it's essentially unique. If something is unique, it cannot be easy to find it. Well, not always. In math, sometimes you have a... if you look... if you look at... this is given relatively explicitly. You have to look at the case of the diagonal exchange, and the formulas are far from being obvious that you should take these formulas. The family of isomorphism. Okay. So, what does it have to do with the? So first of all, why do people do this? Well, so you have definition, the quantum. And I cheated, by the way. The cheat is that for this to exist, you have to shift from an identification between algebra of polynomials and algebras of rational fractions. Well, so you should deform this a little bit. Let me be vague about this. So the quantum Teichmüller space is what you do is that you take the family of all these horrible algebras Q, where lambda ranges over all the ideal triangulations, and what you do is you identify tau lambda Q with tau lambda prime Q, namely you identify the algebraic objects using phi, this phi lambda lambda prime Q. Okay, it's a formal way to make it independent of the triangulation. Now, at this point, I've lost almost everybody in this room. There are two things you have to remember. Is that when Q is equal to 1, tau lambda 1, this is specially designed to mimic the algebra of rational fractions on the Teichner space, on the enhanced Teichner space. So what's that? Well, you take the representations of going into PSL to R. You have still this notion of enhancement. So it's essentially the Teichner space you know about. And you look at the rational fractions on that. There is an issue about what rational means, but that exists. And that's what that means. So for Q equal 1, and you have to think of this one as a deformation of this. So that's what the physicists call a quantization. And so it's a quantization of this example. Now, when you quantize a space, you need something to start at the infinitesimal level, namely that's what's called a Poisson structure. And here there is an underlying Poisson structure, which is the Weil-Peterson form. So quantizations do not always exist. It turns out that in this case they do exist. Eh? Okay, this is That's the setup. Now, what do we do with that? Well, so as usual, I spend most of my talk defining these horrible objects. And then this comes. So what do you do with that? Well, the point is that, if you're a physicist, actually, you realize that by operators on Hilbert spaces and so on. But if you're a topologist, you don't like Hilbert spaces. You like finite dimensional representations. And so when you have an algebraic object, this is just to say, you see a pattern. And so you want to see a pattern, you want to realize this pattern by matrices, because then with matrices, you can do things. And so you want to look at representations of these objects here, which are well behaved under this identification. Now, so when I first started working on that with Xiaobo Liu, the natural thing when you don't know anything is to look at irreducible representations. And actually, we worked hard on that. It's actually difficult to classify. It's not very difficult, but it has a little bit of topology. And but actually, there is something which is much better adapted than the irreducible representations. And these are these local representations. So which you get straight from this setup here. So for every phase, Fj, so peak and irreducible representation, rho j from this triangle algebra associated to the j phase to the endomorphism of a vector space Vj. So that's this, yeah? For each triangle. So each triangle, you associate that. And then, so you pick an irreducible representation like this. And then when you pass to tensor products, this time this is really a tensor product of, this is really a tensor product of algebras. And here, that's actually the symmetric program. I'm still going to use the symmetric, the tensor product, but it's actually the symmetric product of these algebras here. And you get a representation like this. And inside of here, you have this Chekhov-Fock algebra. And so if you restrict, you get a map going this way. Well, so that's, so here, I'm sorry, I want to take the tensor product of the rho j's, and here I get rho. When I restrict, I take rho. And so definition, a local representation rho from the
the horrible algebra associated to lambda to the endomorphisms of this tensor product is any representation obtained in this way. I forgot to say that this guy always has dimension equals n, and this works here when q, so remember that here I need q to the power 2n is equal to 1.
And so, so then, you know, if you think about it here, these guys here, these representations are only classified by number on the edges. Now, to get this, I have to associate, for each generator here, you know, I'm taking a product. So it's essentially what's important is the product. So here I have a number associated here, a number associated to there, but essentially I'm taking the product. So what counts really is the product of these two numbers. And well, you know, we tend to be topologists here. We heard about homology theory. Homology is the art of pushing numbers from one side here to the other side. Eh? And so, so it's not too hard to see. So an easy proposition. It's not a theorem. It's exactly as easy as this, which is that local representation are classified by two things. One, weight xi in C star associated to each edge lambda I of the ideal representation lambda. And then, two, well, you could do that when you push things, but you have this H here, and a root H, and exactly because H was the H was an nth root of the other Xi's, you're going to have exactly the same thing, which is that it's an nth root of X1, X2, Xn, and of that product. So essentially, it's a choice of this. So this is purely algebraic. Okay? This is only algebra. And and the correspondence is the same as before, is that the way you define it is that you take a row of Xi to the power n. Well, these guys are not central anymore, but the representation is not irreducible. So it's, everything is defined so that it's just xi times the identity of my so local representation. Then you grow from this Chekhov-Fock algebra to the endomorphisms of a big tensor product. So it's a big vector space. And So the way the correspondence goes is that you take the nth power of a generator associated to the ith edge. It will be, if you call this guy V, it will be a scalar multiple of the identity. And similarly, rho of H, we have a global H, which is going to be H times the identity of V. And what H is you take the product. What H is actually, it's the product. So here we have one capital H, where is it? It's very, very high, associated to each triangle. You take the product H1, H2, H. So these are the central elements associated to the faces. And well, if you look at the algebra, this is also the product of X1, X2, Xn of the generator associated to the edges, and there is a Q with a certain power, which is a little harder to explain. Okay. Okay. The main point here, this is purely algebraic. And so what's the relationship with what I had before? Is that, okay, how long did you guys talk before I started? The thing is that this is well behaved with respect to the first. So what's well behaved is the fact that you have C and star. So the point is the following. This purely algebraic nonsense, these representations are classified by number associated to the edges of the triangulation. And I also showed at the very beginning that when you have complex numbers associated to the edges of lambda, so if you go, you have a picture like this, which is Cn star. So on one way, you can go to the space of enhanced group homomorphism R from pi 1 of S to PSL to C. And in the other direction, you get a representation of this quantum Teichner space. And then when you identify, you know, you have this identification between phi, lambda, lambda prime. We have two of them. So identify these two algebras. So identify the representations. A little more complicated than that. But, and then, well, here you have Cn. It's not exactly the same thing because these are weights associated to the wedges of lambda prime. Here the weights are associated to the edge of lambda. And then you can go back and forth like this. And then you can also go this way. It's actually an open embedding. And so theorem is that the diagram commutes. Okay. Well, so let me, what do we do? Let's try to understand a bit what's happening here. It's not, wait, oh yeah, with local, yes. So this guy is the space of representation. I put hat to say that it's enhanced. So we have this space which we're going to talk about a lot this week. Eh? That's the space of representation in PSL 2C. Inside, in particular, you know, you have this space here, which is the quasi-fiction space. And inside of it, you have something even better, which is the regular Teichner space. And so, for every point here, I get this algebraic. So I get a point here, I can go back here in general, and then I can get this, and this is nicely compatible. I get a representation. I get a representation of a horrible space, horrible algebraic object. Well, I would never have thought of doing anything with this, except that Kashayev here suggested something, which is that I would never have thought of putting on top of this point, if you fix lambda, I have a representation. I would put perhaps the representation of the horrible algebraic object, but Kashayev suggests to me that we put the space where you do the representation. You have this representation going to a huge vector space. Well, physicists do that. That's why we should listen to them, by the way. Eh? You put that above every space. And what the correspondence tells you is that this is well behaved with respect to changes with lambda. Well, there is and in particular, do I still have the definition of phi lambda? The fact that phi lambda, lambda prime, this is well behaved when you take three laminations tells you that you have a co-cycle. And so actually what we almost end up with a vector bundle
over R of S, which is with fiber isomorphic to C. And so, it is vector space, so it's C to a very large dimension, and N. Well, not quite. It's because that Cauchy condition, there is a certain, you have to worry about rescaling in all these things. So actually what you get is a projective vector bundle over this with fiber CP, and the dimension becomes minus one. What I said, minus one. So you have this very interesting fiber bundle over this, and actually here you have the action of P0 diff, namely of the mapping class group, which lifts in a very natural way to that thing. And actually what you get is a projective bundle over the moduli space. So in particular, and if you restrict, I don't complete, if you take the whole representation space, it's bad, but just restrict just to the Teichmuller space, modulo the action of P0D of S. Well, you get this interesting object, and I don't have time to explain why we do that. It has to, something to, so for instance, this projective bundle actually has no lift to a vector bundle. It's one of those things which it took me a while to realize. There is an when you have a complex projective bundle over a space, there is an obstruction to lift it to a vector bundle. It's not true for real. I never got that thing about the complex numbers. You know? So there is an obstruction which is in H2 of the space. The obstruction is in non-zero. Now, so it's in H2 of the moduli space. All the classes there are well known, so I'm sure it's a well known. It's one of those tautological classes. I'm not completely sure which one that is. The goal of this, which I didn't have time to really to talk about, is to see what's happening actually with. You want to relate these to three-dimensional objects, and in particular, hyperbolic volumes. And you can extract more information from this action of the mapping class group on this space, which should be related to a three-dimensional hyperbolic geometry. So unfortunately, and I can never time this talk very well. Okay, sorry. Thank you. This is always, I'm sorry, yeah, it's always, but you know, picking a root for a complex number, if you control the geometry, usually you can control how to choose nth roots. Yeah, okay. So I should have put plus choice of an nth root here. However, it's a little technical annoyance, which is not very serious. Let's put it this way.